You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting from the Sea Ranch, California. And today we're talking about navigating growth hormone replacement. Some of the issues I'll be covering today largely are derived from my experience practicing in the United States and dealing with commercial insurance and some self-pay patients. These issues may or may not apply to those of you living in other parts of the globe where insurance plans are different. There's national health care, for example, etc. Well, as with anything, there's a process. It all begins with a suspicion of growth hormone deficiency, followed by perhaps screening tests, including an IGF-1, and determining the pretest probability of having the disease, and then it may proceed with stimulation testing. In the United States, the glucagon stimulation test and the arginine stimulation test, insulin tolerance tests, are the three main tests that we proceed with. I'd covered before in another podcast the fact that we're looking for growth hormone levels that are under 5 to sort of confirm a diagnosis. Over 5 are usually considered normal and certainly not candidates for growth hormone replacement as far as the FDA in the United States is concerned. At any rate, once a stimulation test has been done and a diagnosis of growth hormone deficiency has been confirmed, it involves a visit to review much of the information that I've presented in this series of podcasts on growth hormone deficiency, sort of going through the risks, the benefits of treatment, the anticipated recovery from growth hormone deficiency in the time course, etc. The next step is in the selection of an appropriate dose, and that varies according to age, sex, concomitant medications, probably the severity of the growth hormone deficiency, for example. And that process is too complex to really focus on in a podcast, but just understand that, generally speaking, young people who have not completed their long bone growth require much higher doses than do young adults, than do middle-aged, and than do older adults. And that's typically what we see in our clinical practice. The responsiveness to growth hormone and the IGF-1 levels that are achieved, and certainly the age-matched IGF-1 levels, all that has to be taken into consideration to decide on a starting dose for a patient. As I alluded to earlier, we typically start with low doses and stair-step up to find the least amount of growth hormone necessary to achieve a biochemical and a clinical endpoint. Physicians have a lot of information to sort of sort through when we're trying to decide on the dose of growth hormone. For example, a woman who takes estrogens requires a higher dose than a woman who does not. And if a woman is on estrogens and growth hormone and then discontinues her estrogen, she's going to require a lowering of her dose of growth hormone. Some patients who take steroids do better if they're taking dexamethasone or if they increase their dose of hydrocortisone, because growth hormone does accelerate the metabolism of hydrocortisone, but not dexamethasone, so we have to look into that, and certainly growth hormone can affect thyroid hormone dosages as well. Not only are we selecting a dose, but we're selecting an administration interval, so growth hormone usually should be given daily at bedtime. Since most of our growth hormone is made at night, we like to give it at night, but I have some patients who prefer every other day, so they're not doing injections every single day of the week. So after all of those considerations, a prescription is written. And unlike many other prescriptions, you don't leave the doctor's office with the prescription and go to your pharmacy to get the drug. Unfortunately, at least in the United States, we write a prescription. We have to fill out a form, and that form goes to whichever of the manufacturers of growth hormone your insurance company has partnered with. Insurance companies partner with pharmaceutical companies just to keep the cost of medications down. So, for example, a company like Lilly, which makes insulin, and Novo Nordisk, which also makes insulin, might want to sell their insulin to your insurance company so that the people covered by your insurance company can use their insulin. So they may cut a deal and underbid one another, and whoever gets the insulin prescription for your pharmaceutical company would be the company who also gets the growth hormone in. So you might use Lilly growth hormone because Lilly sold insulin at a cheaper rate, they say, than the Novo Nordisk did, and therefore you can't use Novo Nordisk growth hormone. That's unfortunately how it works. So we do a prescription. It goes to whatever company your insurance company has contracted with or approves. And fortunately, some insurance companies haven't contracted, and they permit other different brands of growth hormone. Some companies have different iterations of or devices of administering growth hormone. So Pfizer, for example, you can use the MiniQuick, and they also have a pen device. And we sort of take that into account as far as your lifestyle and what might work best for you and your travel and whether you want something that can be refrigerated or not. Now, there are lots of factors, but at any rate, it goes to your insurance company and it goes to the company that is covered by your insurance company. And they get together and decide whether it's authorized. And usually, if your prescription comes from a pituitary endocrinologist, most of the time it's authorized. If not, we might have to do an appeal process. And generally speaking, we win most of those appeals. We rarely lose them. Ultimately, your growth hormone's approved. And then once that happens, the drug company will contact a specialty pharmacy that they may work with or a plan of support that helps navigate all of this, and ultimately a specialty pharmacy ships growth hormone to you, and someone comes to your house and teaches you to do the injections. And this whole process from the prescription to actually getting your first injection can take anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks, and I've seen it take up to 3 months in some patients. And as physicians, we don't have any control over any of that timing.
At any rate, at some point, you'll start your growth hormone injections, and growth hormones, like any other hormone, we have to use the scientific process to determine if the dose is appropriate and if there's a clinical response. And what that means is you're required for to attend follow-up visits.
In my practice, we insist on follow-up 6 to 8 weeks after starting growth hormone, and then every 6 to 8 weeks after a dose adjustment. Somewhere along the way there, we might let you go to a Quest lab to get an IGF-1 level sent to the office. But usually we like to see how you're doing. We want to know if there's any symptoms or signs of side effects and any evidence for benefit in addition to correlating with the biochemical values. Once your dose has been achieved, we like to see you at 6 month intervals to ensure that everything is going well. At some point, 3 to 6 months after you achieve your final dose, we'll want to assess your thyroid hormone levels. We're asking about symptoms of adrenal insufficiency, for example, to make sure your steroid dose is fine. And then ultimately, you get on chronic management. And that can be annually, but most insurance companies now are requiring reauthorization at 6 month intervals instead of 12 month intervals. That's a royal pain. It's a lot of work for my staff, and it takes so much time that we're starting to go to a process of coming in every 6 months so that we are actually reimbursed by your insurance company for continuing your prescription, evaluating the laboratory work, and doing the tremendous amount of work necessary to maintain growth hormone replacement. And this whole process may seem nonsensical, and a lot of it comes from the fact that growth hormone is expensive. But not only that, probably more importantly, that growth hormone is a drug of abuse. It's an anabolic drug, and many athletes use it, and there are a lot of people out there who are the aged population who believe that growth hormone is a fountain of youth, and they want to take it, and they often will pay for it. But at any rate, these two potentials for abuse or misuse, however you want to clarify it or state it, have led to the fact that growth hormone is very intensely regulated at the level of the FDA and also the pharmaceutical companies that make the drug. During this process of follow-up, we're looking for symptoms and signs of excess growth hormone, in which case we might be required to lower the dose, or insufficient therapy, in which case we might be required to increase the dose. I'm one of those physicians who believes in dose optimization, so if you're going to go to the trouble to take an injection every day, I'm going to go to the trouble with you to ensure that your dose is appropriate for you. Oftentimes, optimizing therapy, that even though your IGF-1 level may be normal, it might not be where I want it. And I usually like to see them right at the middle of the normal range or slightly in the upper half of the normal range. Not necessarily in the high part of the normal range unless you're tolerating that without symptoms or signs of side effects of treatment. Now, I've talked a lot about IGF-1 levels, and we certainly use that as a surrogate to assess whether or not a dose is effective. The interesting thing is that the benefits of growth hormone replacement usually follow once the dose is appropriate, as evidenced by IGF-1 levels, and that's why we put a lot of emphasis on that particular result. We care about how you feel, but we've got to drive that number to where we want it and then see what benefits follow. And that's relating to something I said in earlier podcasts, where oftentimes the symptoms and signs of growth hormone deficiency are so common that they're not related to growth hormone deficiency, they're related to something else. So, for example, maybe you've got kidney problems or heart problems or liver disease or anemia causing your weakness and fatigue, and growth hormone is certainly not going to help that symptom and sign. So we like to follow people to look at the IGF-1 levels, but also to hear about the clinical benefits and also to ensure that they're not having any adverse effects of therapy. As I've mentioned in another podcast, those benefits may follow and continue up to 12 to 18 months after the initiation of treatment. So that patients certainly do deserve follow-up to ensure that their dose is maximum and that they're headed in the right direction after starting growth hormone. One other thing to mention navigating the therapy with growth hormone is that when people change insurance companies, sometimes we have to go through the whole reauthorization process. On a couple of occasions, I've been required to perform additional stimulation tests, which I thought was preposterous, but that's what we have to do. So when you change your insurance company or you have an open enrollment, it's about time to think about a new insurance. If you change jobs, look in advance to see what's going to be required so that hopefully your therapy is not interrupted for too long of a period of time, so that you can sort of be proactive and maybe address some of those issues in advance of some of those changes. One other thing in regards to changes is some people move, and it's important to find a physician who recognizes the benefits and is proactive in regards to growth hormone replacement. Not all endocrinologists are, and I've seen patients who have gone elsewhere, and they call and say, my doctor won't continue growth hormone. I'll help them find someone who will. And then people move to the Bay Area and come see me, whose other treating physicians were not, quote, believers, unquote, in growth hormone replacement, and they find that I am, and we start treatment, and they feel marvelously well after 6 months of therapy. So when you're looking for new doctors, you need to sort that out as well as you try to ensure that you achieve and maintain the best health possible as a pituitary patient who has growth hormone deficiency. Well, that's it for now. We would like to hear from you. If you have any particular questions about this or any other podcast, please post them through our Facebook page or on Pituitary World News. Have a good night. And once again, Lewis Blevins, Pituitary World News. Thanks for listening. Bye. Take care.